And welcome to another edition of Odyssey. We talk about ancient mysteries, metaphysical topics, and unfiltered, non-corporate news of the day. I'm your host, Mike Schultz. Today we're going to really dig into the ancient astronaut theory. And so many of you listen to my show every Thursday, and we talk all about the ancient monuments all around the world. We have a real expert in this story. He's been researching this subject for years, and his name is Jason Martell. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me on, Mike.
Okay, a lot of us kind of first got exposed to it by watching a documentary called Chariots of the Gods years ago. Tell me how you got involved in this material.
Sure. Well, I'm 32 now, I'll be 33 next month. So when I was in college, roughly in my early 20s, I was introduced to the idea that there were possible structures on Mars, you know, artificial structures, which we've heard as Cydonia or the face on Mars. And, you know, as a layman college student having no knowledge of ufology or, you know, ancient civilizations with, you know, technology, I really was taken aback by these images that were clear NASA data that showed to me what looked like a huge face on the surface of Mars and in that surrounding area, pyramids and such. So I was attending college in San Diego, and it turns out that one of the principal imaging scientists as a contractor through NASA is called Malin Space Science Systems, which happened to also be in San Diego where I was attending college. So I contacted Dr. Mike Malin, the principal imaging specialist for the cameras that we have, the Mars Global Surveyor and a couple other ones that we have up there now, Themisys and Odyssey. And I asked Dr. Mike Malin, I said, listen, as a college student, I'm very interested in these images. Is there any possibility that there could be artificial structures on Mars? And he said, point blank, no, this is all sand and weather eroded surfaces, nothing artificial. And so this really led me to do my own independent approach to analyzing this data. I found 5 to 10, 15 peer level review scientists that might not work at NASA, but hold PhDs in imaging like radar, telemetry, things like that, that showed that you can use mathematical algorithms and processes like we do here on Earth to process satellite data of, you know, surfaces on the Earth. If we apply these same processes to the Mars data coming in from NASA all the way back from the 70s, it shows that the face and pyramids have a very large number to be a probability of being artificial. And so these were the initial areas, Mike, that really sparked my interest into saying, okay, well, wait a minute. Here are things I'm trying to figure out on another planet, let alone all the megalithic monuments which I started to realize exist all over the Earth.
So it really opened up Pandora's box, the pyramids of Mars. Now, for a lot of us, the story kind of begins at this massive archaeological find in Iraq or Samaria in the mid-1800s. Why don't you tell us about these thousands of clay tablets that were found and what they tell us about the creation story?
Sure. Well, you know, again, so in realizing that, you know, we have things all over the Earth, from the Nazca lines to the Giza pyramids and the Incas and the Mayans, all these great monuments that are left by civilizations that we still can't quite pinpoint who really built them, meaning the Egyptians claim to have built the pyramids in Egypt, but there's a lot of research, which we can discuss, that shows, no, the pyramids and the Sphinx were built much, much thousands of years older before 2500 B.C., maybe 10,000 B.C. or even way beyond that. So this started to make me want to figure out, okay, who is the oldest civilization that we have record of on Earth? Where do we come from? And it turns out through our own accepted sciences and archaeology of today's, you know, modern view, we place this on the shoulders of southern Iraq. Today's southern Iraq, 6,000 years ago, was then called Sumer. Now, we've heard of this as Mesopotamia, Babylon, and ensuing cultures who have occupied the land, which is now southern Iraq. But 6,000 years ago, the first complete civilized culture that we find, or civilization, I should say, is called Sumer. And the reason why this civilization is so amazing is not only are they revered for being the creators of over 100 of the firsts needed for a civilization. For instance, they were the first ones to have writing. They had a system of writing that was based on 400 characters. Here we are with our 26 letters. Right out of the Stone Age, first culture has a 400-character system called cuneiform script. And they used what looked like a large, oversized screwdriver. And when twisted and turn it in wet clay, which was a commodity easily found in their region, so they would write these characters into clay and then would put these clay tablets in a kiln, a stove, a primitive stove, that would then make the clay turn into stone. So that phrase, literally, writing in stone, is something that the Sumerians perfected. And aside from writing, again, there's just over 100 of the first. So writing, math, science, systems of courts and laws and judges, education, immense knowledge in astronomy and astrology, which we'll discuss. There's a key number into that theory of why there's 12 houses of the zodiac. And the interesting thing about the Sumerians, again, is being the first ones to have a mathematical system. There are a lot of the things that we still use today, which we can pinpoint now and say, going back through Greece and various other cultures, to say, look, they all pinpoint back to Mesopotamian sources, which is then called Sumer.
Sure, like our timekeeping system of 60, isn't that goes back to Sumeria?
That's correct. They had a very complex math system called sexagesimal. We just usually call it 60, but it's basically they devised a math system based on 6 and 10, and it allowed them to do very large geometry as well as very small numbers in geometry, very accurate precision. And it was just an interesting coincidence that their knowledge in math also filtered into another area of astronomy, that with their ability to write and record information, they've left us information on these stone tablets now that are over, 4,500 years old, somewhere in the range close to 6,000 years old, some of these, the very more simpler ones. But we have these long, very drawn-out texts that, here's the kicker. Now, again, these are in stone, and many of these tales have very strong biblical parallels. Let me give you an example.
Sure.
In the British Museum, there's a tablet on display called the Flood Tablet, and it was discovered by a British archaeologist in the late 1800s when they were doing excavations in Iraq. One of the assistant curators pulls this tablet out, and he starts reading it and realizes it's a primitive Akkadian derivative of cuneiform script, which is just the same basic system, just a slightly modification on some of the characters. It tells the story of a Sumerian man who was chosen by God, but not God, a god, called an Anunnaki. And in English, that just means those who from heaven come to earth. An Anunnaki, a Sumerian god, chooses a Sumerian man to build a ship because there's going to be a great flood.
That sounds familiar.
So here's the kicker. This is a stone tablet, and it predates any English or Old Testament version of this tale recorded on a paper version.
Sure. So the tale of Noah's Ark is told much earlier in Sumer.
Correct.
And so what about the creation story? As you go through this cuneiform, what do they say about how beings first came to Earth?
Well, that's, again, as we get into some more of the esoteric points of this and the crossovers between science and what science would then say, oh, well, the Bible, Christianity, or whether it be the Quran, or whether it be Mexico or India with their Vimanas, every culture around the world speaks of a time when beings from the heavens visited us, and it's recorded as a mythological tale that we now hold in that sense from a scientific view. The research that I've done by others in this field with this overall topic, calling it ancient astronauts, is very simple. The people in the past were influenced and visited by beings that came from other planets. And there's very specific information about some of these cultures, like the Sumerians, who have told us that their gods, the Anunnaki, came from another planet within our own solar system. Now, if they were to just say that and write it down, and there was no reference source or anything, sure, that could be mythology. But they've left us science and facts which corroborate and extol why we should listen to what they're saying, in the sense that, for astronomy is an example, they have information that shows the distance between the planets, what the planets look like in space, and we were able to confirm that when we sent the Galileo and Voyager probes and started taking color images. So they tell us that there's also an additional planet out there, which they called Nibiru. That just stands for Planet of the Crossing. And they gave descriptions of this planet on stone tablets that actually describe our whole solar system with the sun in the center and all of the planets we know of accurately around it. Very, very amazing information for a primitive culture to have just amazing, accurate astronomical knowledge. So the kicker to answer your question there, Mike, was this. They say that the beings that they worshipped as gods, the Anunnaki, came from another planet, came here originally around 300,000 years ago, and there's long texts. Like, for instance, we have in the Bible 7 days of creation. Well, there's a text called the Atrahasis and a couple other stories, the Epic of Gilgamesh, where there's 7 tablets of creation, 7 stone tablets that explain in a much more thorough, longer tale on how we got here. And that tale is simply this. The Anunnaki came here seeking fine, precious elements like gold to repair their planet's dwindling atmosphere. On their own rise to technology on their planet Nibiru, they started to ruin their atmosphere and experience all the things that we are. And so the story is written that they came here to mine the gold in southern Africa 300,000 years ago, didn't like having to mine the gold. It was a great toil. So they created a worker race, and they used genetic engineering, basically the Neanderthal man that was evolving here naturally on Earth. They took 80% of their genes, this extraterrestrial gene, and combined it as a base with this hominoid that was here using 20% of that gene and created us in their image and after their likeness, just like the Bible says, to be a slave and a worker to mine the gold. And eventually, as a long drawn-out answer to your question, eventually they created a second version of this that was able to procreate. And that's basically how we came into existence. And there is scientific evidence, again, on that same level of, you know, how trippy does this information get? But in the time, there was an article published around 4 years ago that shows that the mitochondrial DNA, which is the DNA signature in your cell that says it's passed inherently through mothers only and says, you know, this is the genetic sequence, the makeup that we have now as a human being, is carried only by the mother. And the mitochondrial DNA sequence that shows our genetic makeup of the current hominoid shows up in southern Africa 300,000 years ago.
That is pretty amazing. What I want to ask you next is about daily life in Sumeria. What was it like? Because my understanding is that humans were interacting directly with many different types of gods. There was a pantheon of gods. And then somehow that got distilled into one main god of the Old Testament. Why don't you talk about that?
Great question. Well, basically, as I understand it, through the research of Zachariah Sitchin and others like Eric von Daniken, specifically with Zachariah Sitchin, who's a linguist, one of about 200 that can actually translate these ancient languages, the story goes that, you know, there was a time when, just like the Bible says, there were giants upon the earth. Well, the Sumerians have tales and written extremely accurate records on their day-to-day lives of exchanging documents. I give you a mule for some barley, all types of, you know, exchanges of information. And a lot of this information had to do with information recorded in the high courts of priests by the Anunnaki to the priests, where a scribe, a human scribe and a human priest, were interacting with the Anunnaki and taking down information. Meaning, if you were to ask a Sumerian man, how is it that you know all of this information? Where did you learn all this? They simply say, and they wrote this, and they say, all that we know, we were taught by the Anunnaki. So on a day-to-day basis, there were high priests that, in a very, very, you know, sacred role, it's kind of like you'd see in this Mel Gibson movie where the high priest on the Mayan temple is like, oh, you know, and he's the man. He's the guy on the top of the pyramid. There were high priests back in Sumer that had the very sacred knowledge of interacting with the gods. They also had scribes that would assist them. A scribe was someone that could read and write Sumerian text. Not everyone can write Sumerian text. They had kind of like a primitive printing press, where what they would do is they'd also inscribe information they needed to disseminate onto what was called a cylinder seal. It's kind of like a round rock, like a stone scroll. And they would reverse carve information on this scroll so that when you'd roll it over wet clay, it would leave a positive imprint. And they could basically roll these out really quickly and fire them up as stone tablets and disseminate them through the town as information. So one of the things that happened here is over time, the Anunnaki, like you said, a pantheon of different beings, you know, just a different race with more technology and more advanced spiritual ideas that have bestowed knowledge and wisdom to us, an ancient culture living in stone, you know, clay huts and using stone tools, beings with technology have, you know, come out of the heavens. They're gods. They don't know the difference between aliens or gods. So the point being is that, you know, when we look at these stories told about their interactions with the Anunnaki, it makes sense that if the high priests turn to them to get all this information, and all of a sudden the Anunnaki start having fallouts between each other, warring against each other, having their people fight the other clan's people. Like, some worship this Anunnaki, some worship this Anunnaki. And the Anunnaki, again, if we're made in their image and after their likeness, it makes sense that they have a lot of the same appetites and interests that we do. That's why all the Bible's tales sound very similar to, you must fear God, and God is, you know, he will take action if you wrong against him. He has a lot of the same emotions displayed in biblical tales that we can now see very specifically what the Anunnaki would be like in their interactions with the Sumerians.
Yeah, the Old Testament makes so much more sense now that we understand the Sumerian clay tablets. I want to shift over to Egypt. Now, they also believed in the pantheon of gods. They interacted with them directly, and they had all of these artwork they left behind of animal-human hybrids. Were they referring to genetic manipulations before the flood? What is your take on these animal-human hybrids?
Well, you know, I couldn't really give you a thorough answer on that one, Mike. You know, that's not really something that I've come across in my research to say that, yes, there were remains found that could substantiate the idea that there was an actual, a sphinx or a Matterhorn or some weird animal that was, you know, genetically combined by, you know, different species. It does make sense that if the Anunnaki were able to create us and do other genetic experiments, that they could more than likely have such things created. And we do see, even in Sumerian, like the Sphinx and various things that do carry over. But I really couldn't give you a final answer on that one.
Oh, it's a big puzzle, huh? I keep asking people.
maybe at some point in our future, you know, some of this would be brought about, again, by our own sciences, if not already, but in a public manner. So.
Absolutely. Now, do you have any sense of when the flood was, or was there more than one flood? I mean, some people say 10,000 BC, others bring it much earlier. What do you feel?
Well, you know, based on the Sumerian records, there was, you know, a tale told, and it's echoed through other cultures, of a great flood that took place. And really, it's a geological path that I would take in today's search to answer if there was a great flood, using our technology and the way we look at things. One thing I would point out is just to say this, as we touched on Egypt, you know, the pyramids and the Sphinx are claimed to have been built by the Egyptian culture around 2500 BC, and, you know, roughly 4,000 years ago. And what we can say is that using star charts and constellation mapping software, Redshift and various other PC, you know, you can run it on Windows, and it'll tell you, okay, tonight, if you're in North America at 9 p.m., the constellation of Orion will be 4 degrees to the northwest, and you can look, boom, there it is. But this software also allows you to go backwards and forwards in time, thousands of years, to plot star constellations and see where they're going to be in position on relation to the Earth. And it turns out that in 10,500 BC, we have a constellation alignment where it's a terrestrial map of Giza mimicking the sky. And what I mean by that is, in 10,500 BC, the Orion constellation is directly paralleled in the sky with the three pyramids in Giza, and it's an exact replication of how even the bottom smaller pyramid is offset slightly.
Absolutely.
And also, the Sphinx at that exact date is gazing off into the east, directly staring into the constellation of Leo, which is a lion. And so there's a terrestrial alignment of the sky in 10,500 BC with those monuments. So that would be pretty good for them to have built it in 4,000 BC and somehow know that it was going to align in their past. It doesn't make sense. And there's also the geological evidence that shows the weathering on the Sphinx and the surrounding walls have been inundated with rain. When was the last time it was raining in Giza? Probably about 10,000 years ago.
that does make a lot of sense. Now, I know your expertise is in ancient technology. Why don't you give us some of the best evidence of very old ancient technology going back thousands of years ago that was way ahead of its time?
Sure. Now, this is a kind of a preface to when I talk about the Sumerian information. We in our limited time together today, Mike, just kind of jumping around on various topics. But the Sumerians is really kind of the pinnacle of where I lead to say, look, you think all these things we just discussed, well, look at the Sumerians. Well, it turns out, as an example, this is nothing new, how ancient people would react to technology, meaning the preface of what we're saying in the ancient astronaut theory is that a primitive culture, you know, was visited by beings with more advanced spiritual understandings and technology. Who's to say that angels in their realm of, you know, if you're a religious person, who's to say that angels in their realm of reality don't utilize technology just like we do?
Sure, so, it could be angels as well.
Yeah, so the thing is that there are, in, even in modern-day tales, we have, right after World War II, when United States troops flew into southern Africa to set up base camps, you know, there are primitive tribes that came up and greeted the soldiers when they stepped out of their plane, you know, the little prop planes, and the soldiers have cigarette lighters and voice recorders and hold it up to the primitive guy, and the guy's, you know, speaking in a native language, and all of a sudden he plays it back to him, and he's never, he can't believe it. He's recorded his voice. It's amazing. He lights his cigarette. He has the power of flame. They just got out of a flying vehicle from the sky. What happens is, it's the theory of a cargo cult, where all of a sudden you have these ancient cultures, excuse me, these primitive tribes that get exposed to technology, our modern technology, and they start to worship it. So the camps pack up and leave, and they start to scrape away runways and make straw models of planes and start worshiping them. And this is a documented case of how any low civilization tries to mimic and copy the more advanced culture. And we see evidence of this technology throughout the cultures of power of flight being shown. And I'll get into some specifics for you here.
Sure, go ahead.
So when we start, for instance, like in Egypt, there were models found. One was found in a tomb in Saqqara, Egypt, 1898, that the Egyptian archaeologist said, oh, look, it's a nice wooden bird model. But anyone who looks at it from today's standpoint says, wow, that looks kind of like a plane. And it turns out that there was a gentleman named Dr. Messiah who was studying models made by ancients and came across this and said, look, this plane shows similarities to other references that we see in other cultures. For instance, in Central and South America, there are what look like small little airplanes, little, you know, trinkets. They're gold and sometimes made out of silver, and they look just like a little biplane.
Matchbox toys, but airplanes instead of cars.
Right, and the archaeologists there said, oh, well, these are insect models. But again, when you put these all into a basket of many cultures around the world trying to explain that they were seeing something that, you know, represents the power of flight, just like in the Bible when it says, you know, chariots, you know, he came down in a fiery chariot. Or
Ezekiel, sure.
Right, you know, I saw a firmament within the heavens. You know, it's something solid, you know, Ezekiel, right, wheels within wheels, you know. So all of these, you know, explanations by a culture living in clay huts and using stone tools starts to put into perspective the idea that when introduced to a technology, how could they distinguish technology from just saying it's, you know, it's magic or it's, you know, from the gods?
Right. Now, over on your website, which is xfacts.com, a fascinating website, you have a picture of a clay jar that appears to be a battery that was found in Baghdad before Christ. Why don't you talk about that?
Yes. Well, that's the infamous Baghdad battery, and thank you for bringing that up. Very interesting piece of my research. I recently did a special with the Discovery Channel where, you know, on camera, I replicated to scale an actual Baghdad battery. And what this is a small device. They found almost a dozen, I think it's 11 now, in ancient Iraq, where it's just a clay pot. Remember, they did all the writing in clay. It's a clay pot, and it had an iron rod and a copper lining inside with an iron rod down the center, and they would seal it off on top with a little asphalt rubber stopper. And basically they found when they poured inside this clay pot a weak acid like vinegar or a wine, it would actually generate, by putting a positive negative on the copper and the iron rod, it would generate positive volts. And this intrigued many archaeologists into wondering, well, what would a battery be doing, you know, in use 4,000 years ago? Is it possible they can have that type of knowledge? What would they use it for? And in the same hop, skip, and a jump over, we have in Egypt in that same time period, wall reliefs in Dendera in Egypt, which clearly represent gentlemen holding up large light bulbs. Now, modern archaeologists dispute this because they say, well, there's no evidence, we've never found this light bulb. But they've also never been able to explain in these deep recesses of tombs and crypts the intricate wall reliefs and hieroglyphics on these walls and ceilings, they had to have been illuminated somehow to do that. Now, there's no evidence of soot or carbon burning, flame, in those rooms. And the other theory would be that they were using reflection of copper mirrors. There's just no way to get that type of reflection down that deep. So this is an alternative theory, that they possibly were utilizing electricity. And so on camera, I was able to generate, with my Baghdad battery recreation, 4 positive volts that were consistently generating 4 positive volts. So you figure if you have 3 or 4 of these, you get up to a 12-volt battery, 9-volt battery very quickly.
Amazing. Now let's jump over to some of the other continents, such as South America and Mexico and Cambodia, and talk about some of the pyramids that were built over there. Do you feel it was related by the same Anunnaki group later on?
Well, that's an interesting thing you bring up about Cambodia. I have a friend of mine that works over at Dryden Research Facility, NASA, Dr. Walter Klein, and he has been part of a program called AIRSAR, which means Synthetic Aperture Radar Imaging. So it's AIRSAR. If you go online, you can type in AIR, S-A-R, AIRSAR, for Synthetic Aperture Radar. And what they do is they've, for the last 10 years, been flying over with a big DC-8 that has this advanced radar false color imaging technology, so that you can basically go over what they did in Cambodia, as an example. And I'm leading up to some information that hasn't even been released yet on the AP News. We're still waiting for NASA to release their findings. But a recent trip shows that in South America, there were some hidden pyramids found with this AIRSAR technology. And if people want to see what this is or what I'm talking about, there was another discovery about 10 years ago where they have released the data, and it was over Cambodia. And the Angkor Wat Pyramid, they used this AIRSAR false radar technology. They flew over, and it's a huge forest jungle-ish, area. And there was this mound called the Kapilapura Mound, right off to the side of the Angkor Wat Pyramid, like a smaller pyramid.
Okay.
And this was totally hidden. They would have never found it, but using this advanced radar, synthetic aperture radar, they were able to see that there's some large mound hidden by the jungle there. And so they sent in a team of archaeologists and started to excavate it and found that there's a hidden pyramid there. And so I think it's interesting that at least NASA, on some public front, does actually lend its technology for archaeological excavations.
I see. Now, at some point, these Anunnaki, these gods, whatever, they withdrew from public life. Do you have any idea, or can you speculate at all, as to why they went behind the scenes? Do you think they left the planet, or do you think they're still involved somehow, maybe through secret societies or something?
I'm not really sure they ever left, would be my answer. I think with today's reports in ufology and our current state of things that are happening with our, with our current level of understanding, we have things reported all over the world called alien abduction. And this has been going on in our, knowledge for quite a while. And the reports of this are usually having to do with these small beings that have very similar features, the grays, that take us aboard the craft and perform reproductive or genetic medical checkups, if you will, extracting fluid and such. And I mean, this is a very serious topic on a level that, when looked into, like one of my best friends is Dr. Roger Lear, who's been investigating implants in people that are not made of materials that are found on Earth. So the reports of these people indicate that it's possible that if the Anunnaki could have created us, that it's possible they could have maybe, done some cloning or working somehow with another species like the Zeta Reticula, these grays, that they are maybe employed by the Anunnaki to just basically watch over us or look over us, the watchers, however you want to call it. But it makes sense that the Anunnaki could very easily have other beings kind of giving them and relaying the data of their experiment here on Earth.
Now, you have artifacts that look like little gray beings or aliens on your website, don't you?
Yeah, there's another interesting fact is going all the way into the Sumerian culture is they have tales that describe helpers of the Anunnaki, which they called Ijiji, and these other beings that were called, they were very android-like, but there was a series of questions and responses that you would hear from this being, and it made the people realize that it wasn't human. It acted as though it were alive, but clearly wasn't, was the phrase they used. And there's a lot of tales of how these Ijiji helped the Anunnaki fly their craft and, help in medical experiments. and we see these figurines left by the Sumerians, which are small beings with large eyes on a bulbous head, and they do very much, you know, look similar to modern day reports of the Greys.
I see. Now we're just winding down in 5 more minutes. Give me your take on Easter Island. Do you feel it's related to all of these ancient astronaut monuments, or is that a separate case?
I think the Easter Island is a great example of a culture, remnants of a culture that has been left by what I would call the Atlantean culture. And using the word Atlantean or Atlantis is kind of a no-no, but I think we're going to start to see more and more of a shift from that belief of it couldn't be possible, because what I'm starting to see in my own research is the monuments all over the world. We have the Giza pyramids, the Nazca lines, Machu Picchu, South America, Tiwanaku, Teotihuacan, all of these different places, and of course Easter Island. These large megalithic monuments, to me, point to, if there was a culture 10 to 15,000 years ago, however far back it would go, that could have built the actual pyramids, could have built Machu Picchu, it makes sense that they wouldn't be on one continent. They would be a global civilization. And I'm starting to think that the monuments left all over the earth, Baalbek in Lebanon, the Trilithon stones, all these places show a type of technology in stone masonry and geometric placement, or just a not understanding of, like, these huge faces that don't even look anything like the locals depicted in huge megalithic stones on Easter Island. You know, these are all remnants to me of a culture that is now extinct, but must have existed and had high technology to have built all these amazing remnants that we have, that now preceding cultures have come and built their own, little piece, or built their own stone wall over it. But if you were to ask the Mayans or the Incas, who built these structures, where did these come from? They say, these were the homes of the gods, Kukulkan or Quetzalcoatl, But they don't claim to have built it,
No, absolutely. They live amongst the ruins. I believe through my research that they were marking a procession point in the halfway cycle of the Mayan calendar at 10,500 B.C., is there any reference to this Mayan calendar cycle back in the Sumerian writings?
No, there isn't any correlation that I've been able to make yet. And doing my own research into the Mayans, over the last couple of years, I've been very intrigued by, this idea of 2012. But looking at these various ways on their different time cycles, the three different ones, the long, short, and I think it's the Tolkien. They also have this long count calendar, which is, made of these Bakhtuns, and that's where they make predictions of what would happen in various different time periods. And they have made other predictions in previous Bakhtuns where they said, well, in this certain time period, our god, Kukulkan, is going to return. And Kukulkan was described to be a long, fair-haired, or actually a red-headed man with white, fair skin.
Long beard. Yeah.
Long beard, right. And so what happens is in Bakhtun they predict Kukulkan to come back, the conquistadors, invade, and they treat them with the hospitality of thinking they're gods, and, what happens is the conquistadors, aggressively try and convert them to Christianity, burning all the Mayan codices, leaving us, with the three or four now that we have left. So I would say that when we look at their track record of predictions made in that count, in the Bakhtuns of prediction cycles, they haven't been completely accurate that in 2012 what they predict might happen. I haven't seen for my own self, in my research, something that would correlate or give me substantial evidence to say, Planet X or Nibiru is going to be passing through, or the aliens are going to make themselves known at that time. People always ask that. For instance, I would wrap it up with this, Mike, is people always ask, well, show me the evidence. How could they cover up something like this if there were real spaceships and aliens? And my answer is this, and I'll just give you a real slap in the face of information for the people that don't believe in UFOs and aliens.
Okay.
There's been a cover-up going on for the last 20 years of a secret space program. Everything that we have seen from the Apollo landings on the moon is a complete public play through NASA to divert our attention to the real use of space technology that we've been utilizing for a long time. And as we go further and further into our quest, for looking for, like, worms and rocks on Mars and little signs of bacteria, it's going to exponentially go higher and higher until they go, oh, look, you know, we found a SETI signal from a civilization that's 100,000 light years away, or however we can. But this information is not going to be like instantly shown to us, or the aliens aren't going to instantly just show up. We're in a desensitizing process.
Sure, which I think the Hollywood movies is doing with us too, with Close Encounters. They're kind of rolling it out slowly and gradually.
Exactly. I mean, this is a, you know, it's a very complex thing that's going to take time. But in my own exposure to this, I've seen it over a decade now, that when I first started talking about Area 51 and the structures on Mars, and, you know, possible cover-ups of alien technology being utilized in secret labs, people were like, you know, this is just bullcrap. It's not possible. But now today we see these as specials on the Discovery Channel and the National Geographic as to, could this really be where fiber optics and, you know, computer chips came from? So.
Absolutely, little by little. Well, I could listen to you for hours and hours. You're awesome. And I'm going to have to have you back to cover more subjects. But why don't you go ahead and give out your website information so people can check out your work.
Sure. Anyone interested, you can just simply Google Jason Martell with two L's. And you'll find lots of good stuff there. I've got a bunch of videos on YouTube.com if you type in Jason Martell. Or you can just go to my website, which is xfacts.com. And that's X-S-A-C-T-S, xfacts.com.
Okay, thanks for joining us on Odyssey. Take care, Jason.
Thanks, Mike.
Bye-bye. Okay, Jason Martell over at xfacts.com. Fascinating guest. And this is the Odyssey Radio Show. And to find out a little bit more about me, I hope all of you will go to fountainsofyouth.net. I have some pretty cool new products. I'm really getting involved with salt lamps. These are made out of crystal from the Himalayas. They really flood your environment with negative ions, which are so important. As, you know, like when you go spend a day at the beach, you feel really refreshed and have a lot more energy. It's because of there's millions of salt ions that are all around you. That's why people feel so good when they go to Hawaii or Malibu or any beach like that. So you can have this giant salt lamp in your home, and I have them on my website. I even have rainbow-colored ones with different light bulbs that are really amazing. It's kind of the ultimate nightlight. So check out the salt lamps at fountainsofyouth.net. And, of course, my DVDs on the ancient astronaut theory that we were just talking about, The Sands of Time, The Temple of Stone, my two DVDs with they're packed with photographs from around the world. So please check out all that information at the website, fountainsofyouth.net. You can see my picture and find out all about me, myself. So Odyssey is on every Thursday, 9 a.m. in the morning, and we rerun 9 p.m. in the evening. That's Pacific time. We'll get to a little bit of news before my co-host joins us. There was a pretty amazing article that came out this week about the Rockefeller family. Aaron Russo is a real patriot. He, you know, has made these films called Freedom to Fascism, and he became friends with one of the Rockefellers, with Nick Rockefeller, and they somewhat tried to recruit him to get involved in the whole New World Order, One World Government plan, of which the Rockefeller family, of course, is a part of. And they were talking about microchipping the population and merging all these nations together, and really trying to recruit him. So this is definitely something that's going on behind the scenes. And the article that you can read this information is at Infowars.com. That's Alex Jones' website. And, you know, I don't even get my news from television anymore. I just go right to these fantastic websites like Infowars. So please check out that article about the Rockefeller family. And is Candia on the line?
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. We have great weather up in the Northwest, and what's going on today?
What's going on today is I'm actually in Southern Oregon.
Okay.
I'm in Southern Oregon, and it's just as gorgeous here today. I'm down in the land of the metaphysical world of cosmic crystals. I'm in Ashland, Oregon, and it's absolutely gorgeous.
I've heard that's a New Age hotspot, Ashland.
It's a very New Age hotspot. It also happens to be the highest real estate market in the state of Oregon. It's amazing.
Wow.
You wouldn't think of it, to be honest with you. I mean, I grew up coming down here to go to college, visit my friends in college, actually not me. And it's a darling town. It's great over the last 20, 30 years. They've really cleaned it up. But it still surprises me that the real estate market is so high. However, what I love about this energy down here is that it is very cosmically oriented, as well as green, environmentally oriented. We drove up to Mount Ashland ski area yesterday, and they have a full program on environmentally conscious thinking for the ski resort. Now, if we had more towns and areas like that, just think what we could do for America. It's pretty awesome. Have you spent any time here?
No, but I know it's a very progressive town and an arts colony.
Yes.
And very beautiful.
The land of Shakespeare and all those good things. So I'm sorry I missed your show earlier today. It sounds like I got the tail end. It sounds very fascinating.
Well, you'll have to listen tonight.
Absolutely.
To the rerun. Yeah. So what have you got for us today?
Well, as always, I usually end up talking about what's been going on in my immediate world because I always feel that it's very relevant. Whatever's going on in everybody else's world always reflects back to us. And I had a client call me this week that is, she's such a good example for all of us. She called me, she's young. And what's really fun, I have to share this with you, her name's very similar to mine. And her birthday is really similar to mine. I thought, how perfect is that? Anyway, I love the synchronicities of
things. Sure.
However, what she's dealing with is she, again, is young. She's had major bladder problems for the last 3 years. And in talking with her, we discussed that she had a car accident 2 months beforehand, and then she started having bladder problems. She's had bladder problems for the last 3 years. Now, what I feel is really important for all of us to remember when it comes to healing and anything that goes into chronic issues, there are always connections to the emotional body. It can't happen. It's not just physical. And that's what we forget about. You get into any kind of issue, in her case, is bladder or kidneys or cancer or whatever you're talking about, there's usually something that's going on. And for her, of course, it was, okay, so what are you really pissed off about? Now, what I feel is a good learning lesson for all of us is that, you know, yes, you can come to people like me and or go to a doctor, but the real reality on it is actually taking the time to dig deeper, find out the true emotional issues behind it. What are the biggest fears? Because that's what governs all of it. Because if it's not love, it's fear. And find out what is it that's holding her back. And I'm going to use her as an example because it's so brilliant for all of us. What holds us back on our healing? And, of course, it's always us. So it goes into self-healing, self-love. And I don't know about you, Mike, if you take the time every day to think about this, but to love yourself. Now, that's a hard one.
It is.
We think we do, right? However, there are always these little caveats. In fact, to segue for just a second, on the news last night, they were talking about that they are trying to market now more to the 40-year-olds and plus in terms of women and anti-aging. And if you think about it, we're in such a culture where it's all about our looks. It's all about
youthfulness,
okay? So then it makes it much more difficult to love yourself when you look in the mirror going, well, God, I didn't look like this 25 years ago. So I think our culture reinforces the lack of love for ourselves, and I think it takes a really dedicated, strong person to be willing to look at themselves on all issues and love themselves for all of our faults, for all of our issues, for all of our insecurities. So anyway, she was such a great reminder of that, that whole bringing it back to self. In fact, I think I talked about this last week about where you're in the shower, and instead of the shower, as you shower, you always say, I love myself, I love you, I love you. Now, that's hard. And then after a while, you start looking in the mirror and you go, well, that's a bit trite, but it's not, especially for those who have had any kind of physical ailment or dis-ease or chronic pain, chronic issues. It ends up going back to self-esteem and self-loathing. So it's again, coming back to focal point of loving yourself. My old adage is, fake it till you make it. Have you ever thought about that?
I have. So you take time for yourself each day then to do some personal work.
I absolutely do.
Uh-huh.
I do. And I try every morning to take at least, if I can get 10 minutes, great, but if I can get 30, that's better, in the morning. And I don't necessarily, what I would say, meditate. I meditate, in essence, when I walk, when I look out a window, when I drink my cup of tea. However, every morning I try and start my day with gratitude, every day, which of course then goes into loving what you have. And I think that's a great way for all of us to start our day is to, even if you think, oh, wait, what do I have going on in my life? If you really think about it, you realize, like, for example, today, I am so grateful that it is sunny outside. I can't even begin to tell you. It's just awesome. We, as you know, we have had such a long, dreary, gray fall and early winter that to see sunshine, it is just absolutely energizing. I couldn't be more grateful.
Well, I wonder if we're manifesting it, because it's very unusual, and we've been talking about it, and I've been thinking about it, you know.
Oh, I absolutely believe that, and I think that's why. I think it's a really good question, Mike, because I also feel when it comes to the Northwest that every time anybody starts saying, oh, my God, we're going into a drought, what do? We manifest more rain as a Northwest culture. You know, we're all going, oh, no, we can't go there, and so then what do we get? We get inundated. And so, yes, I do believe that. I do believe that we, our bodies are a reflection of the earth, and the earth is a reflection of our thinking. So I totally am in agreement with, I can't even say that quickly, in agreement with that.
Well, it's like a nice little blast of summer, and we can create, you know, better weather if we want it.
Oh, I believe that. But, you know, it's going to have to come with all of us intrinsically first. Last week, I brought up a point that in one of my aha moments, I really got the point that, and this is not involving you at all, but women over 40, late 30s, 40s, are having a lot more hot flashes than they ever had before. Now, one level, people can say, yes, we talk about it more, but I feel it's a reflection of the planet, because to me, it's just like global warming, and women are reflecting that in their endocrine systems.
Really?
That's just my, you know, a doctor will probably tell me I'm absolutely cracking, but that is my intuitive take on it from working with so many people and their bodies and their energy fields. So for us to change everything, we got to change ourselves, which goes, of course, back to self-loving. And the more we love ourselves and allow the feminine nurturing energy to come in to the planet and to ourselves, the more we can help the planet as well. Because to me, it's just such a mirror of each other. That's why I brought up Mount Ashland Ski Resort. I don't know how many ski resorts out there have concentrated so heavily on that, but I was so impressed. I was so impressed. But, of course, it falls into this environment down here that it's just so much more aware. I think that's probably why it's become such a hot spot, too, because people that come here are open to thinking and open to keeping things on the right track, you know, for you know, generations to come, where it's clean and the environment is good, and there's the garbage is cleaned up and everything is recycled, energy is looked at from a new level, and you know, you even think about all the different alternative energy resources that people are starting to investigate in. That's exciting to me. And again, all of that then brings it back to me on a personal level of working individually with people. Because then it goes into self-healing. Because the more you take care of yourself, the more you take care of your environment. Because who wants to live in an unhealthy, dirty, messed up environment? And I'm just talking about someone's personal home. And then you take that one step further out into the community, into, you know, the towns, the communities, into the state. In fact, one of my little pet peeves, this is not anything to do with healing, and yet ironically it does, is when somebody has a piece of property and they absolutely desecrate it with all this junk and garbage, and it looks like a junkyard, and it's really not, and it's their home. I'm thinking, how could you live there? How could you possibly live there?
A lot of people do.
They do that, and you think about that in terms of how their souls are and how their individual daily lives are and what it is that they concentrate on and what they live for. And you think about it just like I look outside the window, and it's absolutely gorgeous. There are so many things to do while we're on the planet. It's interesting. I was talking to someone yesterday. She's a wonderful woman. She's very, very cosmic. And what she's working on, she's going to work on opening the eighth gate of the something or other over in Spain. I thought, how great is that? Okay, however, 99% of the population cannot understand that kind of concept. Even people who listen to our radio, they don't understand going out there so far. So how I look at it is bringing it back to a language where everybody can identify with it, so it can relate to their everyday world of getting up, going to work, coming home, taking care of your kids, going to the grocery store, saving up enough money for vacation, because that's what that's what everybody's lives are in essence in terms of their normal 24-hour cycle. So to me, when you and I talk, it's real important to talk so it stimulates people's minds and awareness, at the same time bringing it back so they can deal with it and be encouraged to expand their everyday life. I think that's what you do by bringing in all these different topics that you bring onto the air and that you delve into, which I just think is so exciting, is that it opens people's awareness and thinking, oh, I hadn't thought about that. And then if you bring it back into the daily consciousness of what it is you need to do to be healed, and I don't mean that just physically, I mean also mentally and emotionally, so that we're working on the right track, and then how that spills out into your home life, and again, back into the greater community. I think there's such a good combination, which is what I've talked about before, is the head and the heart connection. And I like the fact that more and more people are discussing that today. I think that was a topic that has been avoided for a long time. And you hear it much more in catchphrases now, because there are all these, you know, words out there that people cue in on. They make sure it's in their advertising or in their books. And some of it's to the point where it's like overused just to catch people's attention. But other words like this, the connection of the head and the heart, I think is very, very critical for the shift in consciousness and where we're going. We've been so much into our heads for the last how many hundreds of years. And then to combine it back now into thinking with our hearts, but then expanding our intelligence and using the rest of our brain, which, of course, from my view, Mike, is where you come in, because you're bringing in all these great topics. I just think your topics are fabulous.
Well, yours are too. Before we go, why don't you tell us a little bit more about, you know, when the media gives us all these perfect images and it can kind of lead to a little depression because we don't quite measure up, how can we get out of that?
That is a really good question. From my view, again, everybody has their own way of doing it, and there are no right or wrong ways. I like to do it by, I start, first of all, by appreciating what's around me, just the environment. To me, that really helps, because then it takes myself out of me, so I'm not focusing on my imperfections. Instead, you think about what's going on around you, and you start thinking about how and what ways you can become more proactive. It could be something as simple as rearranging your bedroom or cleaning out your closets, because you're becoming more proactive in your external world, and in that particular moment, taking you out of that depression of, oh my God, I'm not so perfect. And then as you do that, you concentrate, and you have to be very conscious with your thinking, of being positive with your thoughts. Every time a thought goes sideways, start bringing it back to center and bringing it back to, even if you have to spell out the word joy or beauty, thinking about flowers or what it does is it changes your brain waves. Because every time you have a negative thought, it changes your brain waves and totally changes the chemistry of your body. So the more you bring it back to very conscious thinking, it's how you jump out of that cycle of repetition, because basically all it is are old tapes of programming in your brain. It's just your brain. So take it out of that. And again, you do it by, in my book, by being proactive. And some of that could be just something as simple as looking into some of the topics that you're talking about, because then it takes you out of that inward spiral of self-deprecation, which is, you know, a nowhere losing sight. And then you look in the mirror and you go, oh, I think I'll go get my hair cut differently. Or, you know, you treat yourself by, and that's to me also very important. It's something where you go out and you decide, well, I think I'll go get a latte. Well, that's a special treat for some people, but that in essence is the gift to themselves to say, you know, I deserve it. So the more you value yourself and nurture you is how you start to shift the programming. And again, bring it back to beauty in your mind. Every time your thought goes someplace, consciously bring it back to a focal point of love and beauty. Even no matter how difficult it is, there's always something positive around you that you can cue back into to make a difference.
That makes a lot of sense. Well, I want to thank you for joining us today, and everybody can go to CandiaSanders.com and check out your site and phone you for readings.
Oh, that would be really fun. I love doing readings. I'm so grateful.
And come to my site at fountainsofuse.net to see my salt lamps. I have salt lamps now and my videos. So thanks for listening to Odyssey, and we will see you next week on Thursday. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Mike. Bye.
Bye.